Summit of Portland, hosted by the Creative Music Guild Thursday through Saturday, June 3rd, 4th, and 5th at Disjecta, 8371 North Interstate Avenue in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Historian Joseph Rife talks about a statement by white clergy in Mississippi in 1962 in response to racism.
One of the things the church has to decide is, what's the difference between being the church and protecting the institution of the church?
Born of Conviction on Progressive Spirit. Listen to weekly podcasts on kboo.fm/progressive spirit.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the 16th Annual Village Building Convergence, June 3rd to June 12th, to take place in locations all over Portland. The Village Building Convergence is an annual celebration of placemaking, community, natural building, music, and art. During the daytime, there will be 35 natural building and public arts projects to take part in. During the evening, there will be food, speakers, musical performances, and more. Again, that's the 16th Annual Village Building Convergence, June 3rd to June 12th in Portland. Information on project locations, performances, speakers, and more can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning, and welcome to Between the Covers. I'm your host, Pamela Santos. Today's guest is Helen Oyeyemi. Helen Oyeyemi is the author of 5 novels. Her latest book is her first short story collection, What Is Not Yours Is Not Yours. Welcome to Between the Covers, Helen.
Thank you for having me, Pamela. It's lovely to be here with you.
I find it so lovely too. Thank you. There are magic realism ingredients, again, in your new collection. I've noticed it in definitely your other books, where there's this, it's almost like new fairy tales. And a lot of what some of your writing is described always has these adjectives around magic. It's enchanting or bewitching. Oh, and this one was that you cast word spells.
Oh, yes. Reading things like that always makes me very happy. It's maybe me trying to recreate a lot of the spells that have been cast on me through reading fairy tales, through reading other writers. I feel like all of my writing is a response to things that I've written. So it's trying to get in conversation with my favorite stories. And there is a sense in which I try to say to readers who also like those stories, come in, let's go further in and find out what's there.
I think the way that fairy tales, at least because a lot of times they weren't even made for children.
Mm-hmm.
So but true. We read them as children.
Yeah.
And so sometimes at least when I read fairy tales, I'm drawn back into, oh, is this how I saw the world as a child? Or
yeah, it makes you realize what little savages children are. I mean, all of the things in fairy tales that you read that seem a bit drastic or possibly insane as an adult were things that you didn't even worry about as a child. Like, they just seemed logical. That's interesting as well. I wonder what changes in the mind between childhood and adulthood.
I think, do you make explanations? And is that kind of bringing you back to how you write stories? What do you find magical?
What do I find magical?
Mm-hmm.
I think transformations are the most important things in stories for me. So the stories where people somehow become what they were always meant to be, which sounds sort of paradoxical, but there's a sort of a journey, like a figure of eight in the life of every fairy tale hero or heroine. Whatever they start out as, they rarely end up as, and so many people are in disguise, and so many intentions are in disguise, and just all about, I suppose, reclaiming the past and reinventing it.
There's a lot of change of fortune,
yeah.
For example, or luck.
And sometimes just a change of state or form from one thing to another. I'm trying to think of a specific fairy tale that will like make a good example of that.
I mean, I think of Swan Princess. I think
The Swan Princess. There's the Frog Prince. That one's interesting as well, in that in the way that it's about violence. Yeah, maybe we'll come back to it when I think of an example.
And yet, your characters and the stories, especially in this collection, I still felt like they were grounded in a world we almost recognize. I didn't need to know. I was kind of tempted, like, okay, what mountain is it? You know, like, is this a real mountain? But sometimes I hate to take away from the experience of reading, so I just, you know, do it. And maybe I don't know Catalonia in the first story, Books and Roses, but Sari Doesn't Sweeten Her Tea is set in Suffolk. In these particular 9 stories, I almost feel like it's just so international. It just sweeps so many different times and places. How do you make the decision on where and when your stories are going to take place?
Sometimes it's very simple, like with Books and Roses. I was in Barcelona when I heard about Sant Jordi's Day and the exchange of Books and Roses, and I immediately knew it had to be a Barcelona story. And also, it was in Barcelona where I fell in love with Gaudí. I went to the house that I write in the story, and I was so in love with it. Usually, I feel very ambivalent towards houses, and I feel it's not exactly claustrophobia, but I'm usually very aware of the walls and the ceilings and of being held in, and I just have a very metaphorical experience of any house. But Gaudí's house, that like a living house, and not in a scary way, just like being held, like walking through. And I liked that it was so wonky in parts that you had to walk a little bit as if you were drunk just to like get through doorway. I just liked the whole experience of moving through that house. So I knew I was going to write a story about that. Suffolk, I'm not even sure why it had to be Suffolk. I just knew that it couldn't be London. I was like, there has to be more to England than London. So I set it in Suffolk because I've had good times there. But generally, yeah, the place and the key in the story come together.
I'm glad you brought up keys. And I didn't have to. One of the, I guess, it was very quick if you're reading it from beginning to end. Sometimes I don't read short stories that way. I actually just take them. Like, I jump around if it's a short story. But I knew that this particular one, they were kind of interlinking. So keys kind of run through these stories. And I'm sure that you have talked about it. But, I mean, it actually made me think, and I might not be completely, you know, on the money about this, but it made me think subconsciously of another motif that you've had in your books, twins and twin imagery. And I'll tell you why, is that I can't think of a key by itself without a door or a lock. It's an orphan. And so a key fits somewhere.
That's interesting. I don't always think that, like, at all. When I think of a key, it's very hard for me to think of it. I think that all of the possibilities that surround the key sort of overwhelm the idea of any one lock for me. So when I see a key, and especially when I collected keys from this bazaar in Cairo, which kind of led to me writing this whole book in the first place, I was collecting them because they were so suggestive. They had these handles that were very intricately formed, and there were keys that had... I believe it's called the tip, so the part that would enter the lock, that would have like a little design or some sort of pattern or some sort of interesting worn down aspect to it. And I would look at it as an object in and of itself and think, what is this thing? And I think perhaps because it's so out of context, you then need to invent context for it. Because when you hold a key, you do hold a possibility. It could lead you to treasure or to some kind of disaster that you weren't supposed to be involved in the first place, which is kind of what is not yours, not yours, the title sort of pertains to. You can't be sure. You have to go there. You have to enter using the key before you can know.
And for you, writing just short stories in this particular collection, did you set out that it was all going to be kind of separate stories?
Yeah, I knew it was going to be 9 stories. That was my way of just sort of trying to impose discipline on the madness that was going to ensue. I knew it was going to become, what is the word for it? I suppose complex. I knew that a story with a key in it would become complex because of keys and their tendency to sort of run away from us, or almost seems as if they don't want to have one owner, but to just pass around and sort of give different people access at different times.
That's what I liked about it. I mean, it's for a lot of people, you know, I don't know. If people have preferences for short stories or novels, sometimes I tend to gravitate towards short stories because I can just like consume it.
Yeah, I'm the same.
For you, though, on the writing side of it, do you feel like you spent more time with it because there's 9 separate stories?
It definitely makes you pay more attention to the sentence level and to sort of making sure that each piece fits together well. And so I sort of felt like a craftsman sometimes, like taking out a word and then seeing how the sentence looked without that word and then putting the word back in. And it felt very delicate writing the short stories and going story by story in that way. And even after I had the 9, I would go back and look at them in a whole and as a whole and work with them. But it was wonderful, actually, the whole process of the short stories, and much more wonderful than writing a novel. Which just feels like a big, messy, huge trek, but that has its own joys. But I think that the short story collection was more joy.
So you put work into it, but there was just an ease or something?
Yeah, I think it was because it was lighthearted work. And that's what made it feel, it was more like preparing something pretty, like a shawl or something for a reader to wear, rather than sort of trying to like open up an entire world for them or something, like which feels like a novel kind of has to develop its own rationale and like very, very steadily and all of these things. And it just didn't feel as serious an effort, perhaps.
So it's not to say that your novels are all dark, but I mean, some of the stuff that happens can be dark. It's things can be sinister, but I liked this was kind of lighthearted. I just opened it up and it's Open Me Carefully, written on an envelope containing a letter from Emily Dickinson to Susan Huntington Gilbert, June 11, 1852. And it actually made me feel like I was reading something different. Like I'm just like, And I thought that I was just like, oh, I'm just going to read something not necessarily lighter, but yeah. It's sort of like, no, just take a moment to even just before you step in.
Yeah. And Emily Dickinson was the key of that perfect balance of light and dark, and it being hard to know whether she was really serious sometimes. I came across this letter that she wrote to her friend saying that she believes that she must be Eve from the Bible, because, you know, no matter how hard you read the Bible, it doesn't say that Eve ever died. And her friend writes back, don't blaspheme. And Emily's just like, she didn't reply that letter, but you can tell that she probably was laughing about it. But just this whole, not knowing how serious it is, I think is fun as well. And Open Me Carefully is something that it's the sort of thing that if you got that letter from your friend, you would think, oh my gosh, what does this letter contain? But you'd also think, hee hee, a little bit.
Because it's from your friend.
Right.
And some of the ways that I think your other novels have kind of opened up, they're setting this tone and this, like, oh, okay. But this, I'm just like, I don't know what I'm going to open up. If you're tuning in just now, we're speaking with Helen Oyeyemi on Between the Covers. This is going to be an excerpt from her latest book, a story collection, What Is Not Yours Is Not Yours.
So this is from a story called Donichka and the St. Martin's Day Goose. And Donichka is a 50-something lady who's just minding her own business, walking down a mountain path when a wolf steps out of nowhere and confronts her. The wolf approached, paying no attention to Donichka's repeated requests that it do no such thing. It pushed back the hood of her cape. Oh, said the wolf, and shuffled back so that it was standing on the side of the path, out of her way. Somewhat offended, Donichka stared over her shoulder and into the wolf's glassy eyes. Am I that bad? She asked. Not at all, not at all. No need to take that tone, the wolf demurred. I just thought you were young, that's all. Nope, just short, Donichka said, pulling her hood back up. Yes, I see that now, so please be on your way. But surely you can't be him, Donichka declared with a cutting glance. Him? The big bad wolf, of course. The wolf tugged its whiskers with an air of self-consciousness. The truth is, that fellow is modelled on me. Wasn't he killed by the woodchopper? Yes, yes, but go back to the beginning and there he is again, ready for action. This is the beginning again, and I thought you were her. In a way, it's good that you're not her. The wolf gets to eat a lot before she comes along. She being... Never mind, never mind. I'll just wait for the next one, the wolf muttered. And Dornichka wondered what on earth could be inside that rotting skin. Good, you do that, Dornichka replied. And then a few steps down the path, thinking of the next one, she sighed and returned to the wolf. But what is it you need exactly? You can't be hungry, you just ate an entire wolf. The wolf shrugged its shoulders and said, You wouldn't understand. The forlornness of its voice prompted Dornichka to coax, Come now, you can tell me. Life, said the wolf. I need more life. Do you think it's easy for the seasons to change here amidst all this stone? I see, said Dornichka. It must take a lot. I almost have enough, but I just need a crumb more, something juicy and young. Ah, oh, whatever you are, you really stink. The wolf's haphazard configuration made her own feel loose. She tapped her thighs and forearms. They hadn't changed. She'd scowled whenever her Tadeusz had slapped her bum and chuckled, built to last. But for now, that was a blessing. A group of hikers strolled by. As they realized they were witnessing the encounter of age-old adversaries, they booed the wolf and urged Dornichka on toward her fated triumph, and would have taken photos if it weren't for the fact that Dornichka refused to drop the hood and reveal her side profile. The wolf was happy to pose.
Thank you so much for that.
Thank you.
I did want to ask about that. Just even talking about fairy tales earlier, Angela Carter is one of my old favorites.
Really? This is so interesting.
Company of Wolves. It stayed with me over the years or something. But anyways, so you have a wolf, a so-called wolf, in Dornichka and the St. Martin Segus. And so when I think about kind of anything that has kind of a suspenseful part in your stories, there are these straight out villains.
I do like villains.
And what's interesting, though, it's not like how we know of fairy tales where they're straight out. I mean, there's so many layers and levels to the sinister or so-called antagonists in your stories. Do you relish writing them as that, or do you still just set out your writing characters?
I do relish, and I'm usually more sympathetic to the villain than to anybody else, especially I think if the villain is sort of open about the fact that they're playing a game. I'm thinking one of my favourite novels is called The Woman in White by Wilkie Collins, and it has this villain called Count Fosco who has these little creatures like white mice and canaries, and he's just this really creepy man who just like goes around with little animals all the time, and he just openly declares that he's just having some fun. He's decided to just ruin everything for fun. And I think in any story, especially in something like a fairy tale, there is a sense in which the villain is all that the villain is in order to allow the hero or the heroine to be all that they are. Mm-hmm. So there's a kind of taking on of the burden of all the wickedness in the story. And a villain that can do that sort of smilingly, I almost quite admire, because it must be tiring. And it must be... Yeah, but you don't always want to be... Everyone is so many different things. You don't want to be one stark thing throughout a narrative or throughout a life. So I think that's why I'm well disposed towards villains. In stories, anyway.
And it just seems that they have their own goals, too.
Yeah,
they exactly. have their motivations.
Exactly. They're just not... They're not the same as ours.
Yeah, that's a good thing.
Yeah.
Where are you kind of headed with your writing next? I mean, you've had 5 novels and you have a short story collection now.
Yeah.
Are you going to come back to novels or?
I am going to come back to novels. Hopefully with some fresh energy that I've gained from writing these short stories. I think I have some problems with the form of the novel, or at least the form of the novel and the way that I write it. So I'm trying to work out a way to write something that has the effect of the stories of these linked stories. So we'll see how it goes.
And you had so many different styles too.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's hard to choose.
I mean, there was that one story where you're reading kind of headlines, and it was actually, when you say lighter, I mean, I find it really funny. Just your humor throughout it.
Thank you.
And so that's why even when writing villains or so-called villains, yeah, it's still kind of fun to read them.
I think that this will be a fun book for people with a very dark sense of humor, actually, because whenever I write something that I think is hilarious, I sometimes read it to a group of people and they're like, that's so dark and disturbing. And I'm like, come on, guys, laugh. It's funny. And they're like, you think that's funny? Like a story that I wrote in my book, Mr. Fox, which is a Bluebeard retelling. Uh-huh. It has a lot of beheadings in it. And I think that I read it to a group of fellow writers and they were just like, are you okay? Is everything? And I was like, what? You don't find it funny? So there's that too.
Do you find that it's unexpected? Do you think it's because when you get boxed in as a female author, mm-hmm, they're not expecting you to go that dark?
Yeah, I think it might be that, or that there's possibly an expectation that when you go really dark, it's a sort of wailing, a sort of complaint about one's place in the world. I think that there are a lot of people who probably don't credit female writers with objectivity, which is interesting because some of the most steely-eyed objective writers that I've read have been female writers because they just place themselves entirely outside of the situation and are just telling what they see from that position. Yeah, and that gives me the chills.
I did my research. And for your last book, you had published a writing playlist for Boy Snowbird,
yeah.
For Granta, did you have kind of a playlist that you remember what you were listening to when you were writing these stories?
Oh, yes. The writing of this book coincided with my obsession with Korean dramas, Korean TV dramas. So there's so much K-pop. There is a band called 2PM, and their song All Day Think of You was playing just relendlessly. What was another song? Oh, there was this song by Beast called 12:30, which actually played into the story Presence, where it's always 12:30 in the house. I listened to, some Rachmaninoff. He has this symphonic suite called The Enchanted Lake. That was lovely, actually. That was very good. Yeah, I can't think of any more off the top of my head.
That's so interesting about the K-pop.
Yeah, the K-pop is completely... I have this very small Korean vocabulary that's also very rude because it's from confrontational moments in the dramas. So yeah. Who knows where that will go.
Oh, they run the gamut, honestly.
Seriously, nothing too extreme. Nothing too extreme.
And they jump in time and place.
Yes, so which I love so much. I love so much. It's a great view of time. Because... the flashbacks are things that never happened. Perfect.
In some ways, when I'm looking at a lot of these stories, I'm trying to kind of take them for what they are, but I don't go back and think, okay, how much of this is grounded? I wouldn't have thought that. I would have just taken it, your word for it, that you made up the Books and Roses. Like, oh, no, I don't want to look this up. And
yeah.
Whatever.
Oh, thank you. That's actually... at the height of success in terms of inventing things. Like if it feels like you don't need to check that it's real, then it's real.
Do you feel like because you're writing fiction, you know, that like you're still creating these worlds,
mm-hmm,
how much research do you go into it when mm-hmm, before you start or after? Or is it just as with the house, kind of just being inspired?
Yeah, I think it mainly comes from inspiration. Even with Boy Snowbird, the era, I only did some fact-checking after I'd written the draft because I'm already in my head in 1950s America, like watching all of the old films and the, well, they're not old, but, you know, watching the 50s films, mm-hmm, and listening to 50s music and just very conversant with all of the main pop cultural figures of that era. I felt that I was anchored in that anyway. So I think it's just a mix of the things that in everyday life that really interest me. I feel able to just spin them out into my fiction.
And that's what makes it authentic and very readable.
Thank you.
So, well, thank you so much for coming into KBOO. Helen Oyeyemi's new short story collection, What Is Not Yours, Is Not Yours, is available now from Riverhead Books. You've been listening to Between the Covers, and I'm Pamela Santos. Thank you so much, Pamela. Thank you.
KBOO Wednesday, June 8th at 9 a.m. for the second installment of our podcast series on criminalization, produced by the Center for Intercultural Organizing. We'll hear stories about profiling, criminalization, and featured commentary by CIO staff. Again, that's the second program in our criminalization podcast series, one produced by the Center for Intercultural Organizing. Wednesday, June 8th at 9 a.m. here at your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to be a founding sponsor of the 29th Annual Waterfront Blues Festival, taking place July 1st through 4th at Tom McCall Waterfront Park in Portland. This year, performers include Tedeschi Trucks Band, Dr. Joan and the Night Trippers, Maceo Parker, a Prince tribute with Liv Warfield and the Special Horns, and many, many more, plus two after-hours parties, dance competitions, six cruises, and 4th of July fireworks. This year, everyone will need a pass to enter the festival. Single-day passes go on sale June 1st, and early bird pricing has been extended to June 5th at 11:59 p.m. Again, that's the Waterfront Blues Festival, July 1st through 4th at the Waterfront Park in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm/WBF2016.
I got my headphones on, just on the block. Not a moment to waste, cause I feel the bass drop.
Thanks for the times that you've given me. The memories are all in my mind. And now there's something I must say out loud.